So moving be a little bit ahead, I'd now like to move perhaps in what we would call a more the perspective of the people actually working or practitioner, although you've both had a very good academic background as well that would contribute to this conversation. But I'd like to invite Paula Engvall from now working at CEDA and Wilson de los Reyes Aragon from RFSU to join the discussion. Paula, you have a long experience of working from a rights-based perspective within the education sector in particular. And you are now a senior policy specialist at CEDA in regards to education, but you've also previously been head of the international unit at Lärarförbundet, the Swedish Teachers Union. And Wilson is a doctor in law and currently a senior advisor in international law and human rights at RFSU. And you have both research background, you've worked with international litigation and negotiations, international organizations. You've worked in Latin America, European Union, Eastern Europe, Southeast Asia, United Nations, so in many different places. I see you're also a founder member of Colombian Academy of International Law. Wilson is also a colleague of mine, most importantly. So thank you very much. I'll start with just asking a little bit sort of what you've heard two presentations now. What are your immediate reflections of what we've heard now? Paula.
Okay. No, I think it's, I read the report before, and I think the presentation just clarified some of the perspectives. And I was, of course, looking and listening quite a lot to the education findings. And also about the question you got, Per, about the intersectionality of things. If you look at separate groups or if you looked at universal access, and that is an interesting discussion. And also I think the discussion about leaving no one behind to reach the poor or to reach the poorest is something that needs to be discussed much more. And what implications does it have for development cooperation, for example?
Mm. Wilson,
well, thank you. What I think is that the study itself is very interesting because it opens for too much questions. Most of them are really complicated, as everyone has been commenting on, since discrimination actually and anti-discrimination are some issues that should that are so complex that the approach that we should have for discrimination or working on anti-discrimination should be also as much complex as the issues, such as Per was saying and as the results were showing. So there is no clear answer to many of the things, and perhaps the legal perspective can have some perspectives as well, some ideas on how to deal with several things after the anti-discrimination measures are put in place, which are not usually covered by studies or by reality either.
But I know, Wilson, that you have some experience and you also studied exactly that sort of once the sort of the legal framework is put in place and it's been mentioning one example that's been provided that needs to be combined with attitude changing interventions, for example. But what would you give sort of as the three bullet points of that policy is put in place, what is necessary for discrimination to end, in fact?
Well, put an end to discrimination is kind of, I don't know, perhaps
here.
Too ambitious. Because, I mean, I would like to start by saying that from the legal perspective or the legal philosophy perspective, you should address discrimination as just as a response, as a social interaction response to competition. Mm. So it doesn't matter whether competition is regarding economic resources or whatever it is, but and when you call it from the political perspective, it is competition about power and decision making. So competition leads to discrimination, or at least discrimination is a response from competition. So if you put it in that way and you compare it with the rule of law and you compare it with the democracy ideal, you see that both anti-discrimination and equality is anchored in equality before law, and this principle is also anchored in the whole idea on democracy, or as some researchers have put it, polyarchy, which means the variety of power sources in the law. So this idea of democracy, anti-discrimination, equality before law is actually not natural, and somehow it is really closely related to children parties. If you see, you know, or you perhaps are very full aware of the piñatas, and you Swedes are very aware of the Swedish fishing pots, which is the fiskedam.
Fiskedam, okay.
Yes, because it has something to do with the discrimination and the idea of democracy and how state and the rule of law can intervene when it comes to discrimination and response to be responsive to competition. Because just, the whole idea of democracy as a polyarchy has something to do with the idea that you are giving a lottery when you are born, and you never know actually how, this is called the veil of ignorance, academically. So you never know what's going to be for you there. So for maintaining the system, you need to achieve at least that those who are less fortunate has anyway got something which is still acceptable, as for not breaking with the whole order and still complain with the rule of law and complain with the given order which is in the society at that certain level. But anyway, since this is a cost of democracy and a cost of rule of law, and you are an administrator of the system, you need anyway, or you are tempted to lower the costs. So if you compare it, and this is where discrimination and anti-discrimination should be handled with very much care, since you don't know actually which other dynamics, as you were mentioning, Per, you can just trigger by putting or addressing or putting in place some anti-discrimination measure which is particularly targeting one dimension of the problem, but perhaps you are just creating some other dynamics between inclusion and exclusion. And this is particularly true when it comes to the labor markets. So going to the point, I know I'm a lawyer and I talk too much, but the point is that if you compare it with the piñata, perhaps you can say this way. You are setting a rule when we are saying all children between 3 and 10 that they are going to being able to participate in a party where they can where there is a box full of candy, but anyway it is a limited amount of candy, and then you're saying but everyone should be treated fairly and equal, so no one should be left behind, and you know that they are 10 years old and 3 years old, and then you're saying with this moral perspective, you are anyway given the opportunity to take as much candy as you can take, to get as much candy as you can take. And then you are saying, with this in mind, please go ahead. And then you're going to the kitchen for a coffee. That's not really functioning. You're setting the... perhaps you can even say, okay, let's start by allowing the 3 years old to go to grab their candies first. And then you disappear. You're setting the rule, but you are not acting on the rule. So perhaps that's just too tempting for the 10 years old to grab much more candy than they rationally would take, just because, you are allowed to. And when it comes to these anti-discrimination measures, you are you might be surprised by some examples. Indicating that when you're addressing only one ground for discrimination, for instance, political participation, women in politics, women in labor markets, race and politics, you are just triggering some other ideas, especially for those who are losing as a group, within this perspective and try to perhaps triggering some dynamics or groups dynamics in order to exclude or to create some other exclusion-inclusion rules just for maintaining the order as it was before. So for addressing it, you need to, and perhaps we can go back to it in a while, you have to bear in mind the two main duties of any state when it comes to discrimination, which is when it comes to the rule of law in itself. The first one is to promote a non-discrimination legislation, and the other one is to put that in place. And this requires two kind of tasks. The first one is promoting actively, such as reservations, positive affirmative actions, and whatsoever. And the other one is actually discouraging all those dynamics, inclusion-exclusion dynamics that are created by your own interventions for having some reservations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But in the piñata metaphor, is there, because here we're also interested in looking a little bit on the external actor of now a development agency, perhaps, or a development organizations. And I'm wondering, Paula, because we hear, sort of what I hear is that this is highly sensitive. You go in and you interfere with a structure that exists, and you want 3-year-old to come before the 10-year-old to eat the cat. I'm wondering who they're beating, though. It's a little bit, but in that metaphor, how would an agency, external actor with financial resources and other means, sort of how would you think of going into quite that sensitive area?
I think one of the recommendations in the report is that it is political to interfere in the marginalizations. And I think that is quite obvious, that it's not only a technical matter. If you work with marginalized groups, it is sensitive. You interfere in sensitive discussions. And education in itself is political. Mm. I mean, it's high on the political agenda in Sweden, but it's high on the political agenda in every country. Because when you have the power over who goes to education, what kind of education you get, you also have the power what kind of citizens you get in the country. Mm. So it is in itself sensitive, and you have to deal with it. And CEDA has worked for quite a long time with power analysis that was also said in the presentations about the context analyze and also with the right-based approach, and maybe that is the way of move away from different groups, that you have a right perspective in mind and look at that from a multidimensional poverty, right-based aspect, and also to really look at the context where it takes place. So I think it's, it has to be high awareness that you don't operate it isolated. You work in sensitive issues. Mm. And there are powers for and against different groups. But I should also say that when we talk about education, the Millennium Development Goals were more like, we fixed the education goal, is something I hear quite often. And the whole discussion about the access to education was very good. The kids started school on a global level much more the last 15 years. But now it's what's really interesting, and it's much higher ambitions in the Agenda 2030 when it comes to education. It's both the access and the retention and the completion rate. Mm. It's not only primary, it's the completion of secondary education. It's there where you actually see the big returns of education, and also the connection to the labor market and the skills development that is in the report is grouped with the labor market, but it's also very much about the education sector. So that is something that could be looked more into, I think. Mm.
But in that, follow-up of looking at secondary education, then, how much is CEDA currently looking at who is actually finishing education at the moment? No, how much disaggregated data at that level are you investigating in?
I could say that, the access is not universal. The dropout rate is not fixed. Mm. It's very unequal in the system. And what you actually learn is difficult. You can't only look at who's going to school, is what you come out, what knowledge do you come out with. Mm. But if you are a girl living in the rural area in sub-Saharan Africa, you have less than 1% likelihood to complete secondary education. So we are very, very far from having universal access to education. Mm. And if you look at the multidimensional poverty, And education is very much in the heart of all the analyses about poverty. You have to bear in mind that, well, there are different all important parts of it, but if you deny the first access to education, you deny the access and the right to learn something, you are denied many of the rights later on in life. So the most marginalized groups, if you don't have the possibility to get into school, it will be more difficult. It's more expensive to fix it later on. So the start is very important to invest in the education system first and actually have the completion. And what I think is most important is that while you should not only go to school, you should learn something that is useful. And that is not only about, well, of course it's important to read and write and the mathematics, but also what kind of values do you have with you? What rights do you have in the education system? You drop out because you don't have the rights. It's discrimination system within itself. The education system. And if you can't really work with what's happening inside education, you don't use the full potential of education that can be transformative and actually change the norms that are discriminatory. So I think it's a clear connection.
Per, did you wanted to add something? You stood up as if.
I was just I just wanted to say, just echo what Wilson was saying about acting on the rule, and I think that's something that when we've done research on those things, we've seen that there are lots of good rules out there, and I think we also discussed that before the seminar, that there are, countries are great at adopting laws and having these fantastic rules, but then act on them is something completely different. And I think that's really part of the challenge, I think, to actually implement them and have people who not only implement them, but also, like, for example, when it comes to Rachel was talking about the teacher attitudes, for example, those who are actually going to be there on the daily basis and work with these issues, that actually they are transformed, so to speak, and so on. So I think at implementation and those things, so it's very, very crucial, I would say.
Right, and probably the tricky part.
Of course, yeah.
As well.
Yeah.
And before, I'd like to invite Rachel and Andrew also to the stage, also to comment a little bit on what's been discussed, but also to invite questions. But Paula, I'd like to still stick a little bit with, because the leaving no one behind idea that we have and that's been raised, and it's the foundation also why we wanted to look into that. It's a very ambitious goal, and it's quite demanding as well, both from, you know, obviously the national institutions, but from a development actor. Would you say that CEDA is today what we would say fit for purpose? Do you have, you know, is there a capacity or a political support to actually target the ones that we think would be left behind?
I think one of the recommendations in the report that the universal approach instead of the target measuring is one way of actually dealing with that. If you build a system that are inclusive and reach everyone, you are on the way to do it. And I think it's in the policy framework that was adopted in December. It's a clear system approach when it comes, for example, to education and healthcare, our basic services. That is a strong political support to do it. But I also think that CEDA is quite good at reaching the poor people. And when I talk about multidimensional poor, but to reach the poorest is quite tricky. And one thing that is not in the report but is a great concern is that CEDA is working a lot in conflict areas, post-conflict areas, and humanitarian crisis. And what is it to be leave no one behind in that context? So that is, I should say that it requires a lot, but also a lot of analysis to actually see what does it mean, how should we program, if that is what should be the main priority among other political priorities. So there are absolutely political ambitions, and I think there are a lot of knowledge, but also it requires a lot of thinking how to deal with it.
hopefully this report can contribute a little bit. Rachel and Andrew, do you want to come up and join us? So before I also invite the audience, would you like to comment a little bit on what you heard? And within that, also perhaps I'd like to stick a little bit with the problems that might arise as coming in as a donor. Well, not donor without quotes, actually, that's what it is. But also with the difficulties of being an external actor in a sensitive area. But also I think there might be some long-term difficulties of sustainability, of where in a choice of all these different anti-discrimination measures, sort of, which might be more short-term or long-term as well. How should one think as also coming in and perhaps, well, from a sustainability perspective, is that clear? Rachel, do you want to, or Andrew, do you?
Just on the last question you posed, my gut feeling is that particularly in low-income context or context where there are perhaps many groups suffering from different forms of discrimination, on the whole, inclusive services and will probably be a more effective and cost-effective route to go down with targeted measures as a kind of additional activity. I think there is interesting evidence that in some places targeted measures have kind of outlived their purpose, but then they've still persisted. And I think that's something that also needs, you know, constant review and monitoring to make sure that they're still leading to this goal of leaving nobody behind. Just on the conflict issue, I'm not very qualified to talk about it, but it was very striking how little of the evidence that we found in our review related to conflict-affected contexts at all. You know, we went into it largely from the refugee displaced person angle and were very surprised to find hardly anything on reducing discrimination against those groups. There are efforts around, say, sexual violence in conflict and in the education arena on gender inequalities in conflict in particular, because such a large proportion of the world's out-of-school children are in conflict-affected areas, and it's the inequality is even greater for girls in conflict-affected areas. But that's not really something that the report found any very strong evidence on, though I'm aware of other work that's going on this.
Andrew, would you like to add anything?
I think the problems for the donor, it seems to me that these are really national issues and national agendas. Mm. And donors can be there as kind of sympathetic accompanists, if you like, but more or less in the background, I would say. I think if the donor slips into the foreground, then the danger would be that it's not going to be sustainable. And I think this is probably true, this is definitely true at a sort of macro level if you're talking about new legislation or something. But even within programs and sectors like education, I think it's difficult for a donor to push on some of these tricky issues unless there is a social movement there which is also pushing, unless there are people within government who are pushing, whether it is politicians or civil servants. Mm. So it seems to me that it's potentially very counterproductive for a donor to get too directive in these situations. Mm. I have to say that I don't know, this is a reflection, that I like the perspective of intersecting inequalities, because it, in terms of targeting, it raises targeting issues in a new and refreshing way. So, for example, in work on Bangladesh, on disability and poverty, we found that poor disabled women were likely to find it very difficult to escape poverty. But nothing targets group. You know, the targeting is done at the level of disabled people.
Right.
Or women.
And disabled people aren't
or
women.
Or poor people.
Right. Mm.
And I think if you begin to look at some of the interactions of these, you know, governments are often frightened of targeting. Why? Because they're very, you know, how many women are there in any society? It's half the population.
Mm.
Disabled people, there is a debate in every society about how many disabled people there are, but usually there are a lot.
Mm.
And certainly if you look at households which have within them a disabled person, it would be a very high proportion of households in many societies. So, and then governments get afraid, you know, because if we're targeting all these people, it's going to mean costing a lot of money, and so it's not just the political backlash that you get. You get a technical backlash, if you like, from ministries of finance charged with the budget and so on. So I feel that one promising route in this whole area is to look at these intersecting inequalities and to think about discrimination in that context. And that's something which I'm not sure that anybody very much has done, so that's maybe for the future. And just on conflict, I think I mentioned that we, conflict-affected situations, we are planning a second phase. We are trying to raise the resources for a second phase, and I think it's important in that we look at conflict-affected situations. Mm. We had identified Nepal as a possible country to look at. We're also hoping to work in India, and I think it will be very interesting in a country like India to see how anti-discrimination measures work out in conflict-affected areas compared to other areas.
Mm.
I think the knowledge base there is very, very slim, as Rachel said, and we can contribute to it.
And if I'm correct, that phase will also look at also civil society or social movements, sort of the grassroots activities. I'm saying that because there might be questions regarding exactly the more accountability part, as I see it, sort of from sort of also of changing discrimination in a society.